And both of them's neck were cut the same way. That tells me it was a person who hated both of these people. They wanted revenge.
There were two other males walking around in that house bleeding, and we have no idea who they are. And nobody's even tried to figure it out.
We don't know yet who they are. Maybe one day we'll discover it. I hope so. I'm not sure we're ever going to find out.
Since his trial on first-degree murder charges in 1990, Jens Søring has insisted that he gave a false confession in the murders of Derek and Nancy Hasem. He claimed he stayed behind in Washington, D.C. the night of the murders, and that Elizabeth traveled to Bedford County and returned hours later with blood on her hands. While serving a life sentence for the murders, Jens wrote books and gave interviews, but his claims got more traction after DNA testing was conducted on crime scene evidence for the first time in 2009. None of the DNA profiles matched Jens. But it was another 7 years before Jens and his attorney, Steve Rosenfield, when comparing the blood testing done in 1985 to the DNA report side by side, realized something.
Oh my God. I mean, Steve and I were shouting at each other. Up until that point, it was all about reasonable doubt. But now, this was just a classic case of a DNA exoneration.
What they saw by comparing the DNA report to the blood type report was that Jens did not match the DNA taken from a blood stain of type O blood. They concluded that meant the O blood found at the crime scene, long believed to belong to Jens, had to have come from someone else. Furthermore, DNA from another stain of AV blood found in the kitchen and thought to be the victim's, Nancy Hasem, had a Y chromosome, which suggested it belonged to the DNA of another unidentified male. So, could there have been two unknown men bleeding at the crime scene? Two DNA experts, Dr. Thomas McClintock and Dr. Moses Shanfield, who were hired by Jens' team to review the reports, agreed with Jens and Steve's conclusions about the significance of the DNA, and they wrote letters to the Virginia governor as part of Jens' appeal for pardon. That news grabbed international headlines and reinvigorated Jens' campaign for exoneration.
Details tonight, a man convicted of carrying out a notorious murder in Bedford County is getting new help in his bid to get out of prison.
Best-selling author John Grisham, actor Martin Sheen, music mogul and Innocence Project founding board member Jason Flom, and a slew of high-ranking German politicians offered their support to Jens' cause. The sitting sheriff of Albemarle County, Chip Harding, wrote a letter to the governor on Jens' behalf and spoke at a press conference in 2017, calling for Bedford County to reopen the investigation into the Hasem murders and test additional crime scene evidence for DNA.
Looking at the evidence right now, there's no way in the world I could convict him.
Harding was already troubled by evidence used to convict Jens, and the new DNA evidence convinced him further. And we agreed, finding the identities of those two unidentified men seemed critical to us if we wanted to get to the truth about what really happened the night of the murders. There were already some leads. As early as the 1990s, two men known as the Drifters had been mentioned as possible alternate suspects in court filings by Jens' legal team. William Shiflett and Robert Albright had been convicted of a similar stabbing that happened a week after the Hasems were murdered, and they had been in Lynchburg around the time of the murders. Both had refused numerous times to speak with representatives for Jens. But they weren't the only alternate suspects Jens' team of lawyers and investigators, including Chip, had considered. In the search for the sources of the unidentified DNA, one of the first leads was a physician in Washington State. We'll call him Dr. Doe. He was a student at the University of Virginia with Jens and Elizabeth and had gone on a ski trip with Elizabeth over Christmas break in 1984, the same Christmas break when she and Jens were exchanging those lengthy love letters, hinting at murder. But her behavior on that trip didn't suggest someone who was pining for her lover. In fact, as Chip would learn, Elizabeth was finding plenty to keep her busy an ocean away from Jens, in the arms of Dr. Doe. When Chip learned about that winter fling and that Dr. Doe and Elizabeth kept in touch by letters after her arrest, he decided to track him down in person.
I flew out to the state of Washington on my own dime and found out where his practice was and went by the first day, and they put me in a waiting room. The nurse came in. I showed her my badge. I was sheriff of Alamo County, Virginia at that point. Told I was there to talk to him about a homicide that occurred where he was at the University of Virginia, and he would know what I was talking about. Just tell him that and tell him I was willing to wait and interview him during his lunch break or wait to after hours when he was done if he didn't have time to see me now. And she said, well, he's pretty slammed with patients. But to my surprise, he came in the room with me and about 5 minutes later and wanted to know what was going on. And I didn't let him read them, but I said, I have a number of letters that went back and forth between you and Elizabeth. I know you met her on this ski trip. I just want to talk to you about it. You're persons of interest. You're not what I would really call a high-level suspect, but I'd like to rule you out. And he said, sure, I'll talk to you right now.
Chip asked him about his relationship with Elizabeth on that ski trip back in 1985.
He kind of laughed. He said, sure, if I was in great shape and virile back then, and we hit it off and she wanted to stay in my room with me, and I was all for that. She was beautiful and intriguing. And he said, I could only keep up with her for about two nights. He said, I don't think she ever slept. I felt like she was doing drugs. I couldn't keep up with her, and she ended up hooking up with a bartender who we all felt like was a heavy drug user in Yugoslavia, and I wouldn't wither the rest of the trip.
Dr. Doe told Chip his only contact with Elizabeth after the ski trip was when they were back at UVA, and they ran into each other. He told Chip Elizabeth asked him for money, telling him her siblings had frozen her accounts, so he lent her $500. Dr. Doe said he'd exchanged letters with Elizabeth after her arrest, but hadn't spoken to her in the last 25 years. Chip said Dr. Doe was believable.
He also readily agreed to give me a DNA sample. I brought a DNA test kit with me, took samples of his saliva from his cheek right there. His DNA proved to exclude him from the DNA from the crime scene.
When we started our own research about this case, we knew Dr. Doe had been ruled out. But that left the drifters, William Shiflett and Robert Albright, and we wanted to take a crack at them. William Shiflett had died in 2018 at the Greensville Correctional Center. But his son, Will, was alive and incarcerated in that same prison. He agreed to meet with us, and after months of phone calls and emails, he gave us permission to test his father's DNA, taken during his official autopsy, and compare the results to the unidentified DNA at the crime scene. Dr. Thomas McClintock at Liberty University did the comparison.
I don't have good news to report. There is not a match between Mr. Shiflett's DNA and any of the DNA that was found, or at least analyzed in the 2009 report.
The other drifter, Robert Albright, had insisted on his innocence through an email exchange with us, but he refused an interview. We emailed him the news that Shiflett had been cleared and asked him if he would consider letting us test his DNA. To our surprise, he agreed, but that was only the first hurdle. Collecting his DNA from prison during a pandemic seemed almost insurmountable. We couldn't visit with the DNA kit because the prison was locked down. We couldn't ask him to swab his own cheek because we couldn't trust that he would send his own DNA and not someone else's. But Robert persisted and said it had weighed on him for years.
I'm innocent. I'm going to do whatever it takes to prove I'm innocent.
For weeks, we were stumped about how to collect his DNA. But an attorney we know named Bruce Williamson had a suggestion to see if Robert could request his own DNA profile from the Virginia State Data Bank. Robert had a brain tumor that left him with a traumatic brain injury, but with our assistance, he was able to handwrite a letter to the Department of Forensic Science requesting his DNA profile. but we still weren't sure if he had a legal right to it, or if the letter he wrote even made it there. After several weeks of waiting, we called the Department of Forensic Science to follow up.
My name is Rachel Ryan. I'm trying to help an inmate request his DNA, and he sent a letter a few weeks ago, and I wanted to verify that you received it, and if there was anything else that he needed to do.
Okay, who sent the letter?
His name is Robert Albright.
He is entitled to a copy of his profile from the data bank under the code and under federal law, so I'm going to ask them to pull it. It's just going to take us a little bit of time to get it to him, but we will do that.
A few weeks later, Robert called.
I got good news.
You got good news?
I sure do.
What did you get it?
I got the DNA profile. Now is it time to tell the truth.
Everything we knew about Robert Albright had come from news reports and from Shiflett's son, Will, who it turned out had been exaggerating or outright lying about many things. Robert told us he grew up in Lynchburg and met William Shiflett at a bar. He and Shiflett stabbed a homeless man to death in Roanoke, and Robert pleaded guilty to the crime. His court records show a tortured soul who'd attempted suicide on more than one occasion, and who expressed remorse over what he'd done. He told us he was married for 3 years and has one son, and he talks to his mother once a month by phone. Now in his 50s, Robert is serving a life sentence and has been denied parole multiple times. His name has been brought up repeatedly in connection to the Haysa murders, and he said he's felt powerless to stop that.
What do you think about the fact that people have accused you of this other crime that you didn't commit?
It makes me angry. But ain't nothing I can do about it right now. Money is having that done. If you get money, you get almost anything done.
In this case, he didn't need any money. We paid the postage for him to mail his DNA profile to us, and we asked Dr. McClintock to compare it to the unidentified DNA from the crime scene.
There was not a match between Mr. Albright and any of the profiles generated from 5 different samples that generated partial profiles from that crime scene. It's not even close.
Since we'd already eliminated William Shiflett, this came as less of a surprise. But we knew it would be a relief for Robert when we shared the news with him that his name had finally been cleared through DNA.
All these lies, I just wondered when it was going to end.
Months earlier, when we told Jens that one of the drifters' DNA was not a match, and that the other one had agreed to give us his DNA, Jens said he was disappointed, but not surprised.
All of this seemed unlikely to me. I've always liked Jim Farmer, and in the police sense of liking as a suspect.
The name Jim Farmer has come up in connection to this case many times over the years, starting with Jens' testimony at his trial. Jim was also a student at UVA on a prestigious scholarship at the same time as Jens and Elizabeth. Jim's father was a judge in Lynchburg, and the family was friends with the Haysums. Jens claims the weekend of the murders, Elizabeth told him that Jim was her drug dealer and that she needed to transport drugs back to Charlottesville for him as a favor because she owed him money and didn't want her parents to find out. Jens maintains this is what he thought he was creating an alibi for when he bought 2 movie tickets that night.
It also has something to do with the way that Elizabeth's mind worked. You know, I don't think it was a coincidence that she named him. He was on her mind for a reason that weekend. And I don't know, whether we'll ever find out what that reason is, but.
Jim Farmer was never considered a suspect by Bedford investigators. But Jens has continued to suggest Jim as an alternate suspect and a source of the unidentified DNA in books and interviews over the past 30 years. Jens has also named another former UVA student, one of Jim's friends, as possibly being connected to the crime. We'll call that student Robin. There's no hard evidence connecting either of them to the case, but decades after the murders, a new tip came in that would give legs to Jens' theory about their possible involvement in the crime. The tipster was a transmission shop owner in Bedford County named Tony Buchanan. He says he'd reached out to Bedford investigators years after the crime, and he gave a video statement to attorneys for Jens Søring in 2011. He said a car with blood and a knife inside was brought to his shop in 1985 by a tow truck shortly after the Haysom murders. The car had been found in the woods, and the tow truck driver told him it belonged to some college kids. Buchanan said a young woman who resembled Elizabeth came to pick up the car with a young man. Jens' legal team thinks this was the car actually used in the murders, and that's why no blood was found in the rental car Jens and Elizabeth used that weekend. Buchanan said the young man with the woman who looked like Elizabeth did not resemble Jens Søring.
When I seen his first picture, I said, well, that's not Søring. I mean, that ain't the guy I was here picking that car up. So then it got me in another frame of mind.
In 2011, when Buchanan told his story to Jens' attorneys, he was shown a picture of Jim Farmer and asked if that was the young man he remembered seeing in his shop 26 years earlier. But Jens says Buchanan didn't identify Jim.
He said, nah, that's definitely not him. But the guy standing next to him, that could definitely be him if he had his hair a little different.
That guy was Robin, Jim Farmer's friend at UVA. We reached out to Robin, who appears to have lived a quiet life as an innkeeper, an avid nature lover. We asked him if he'd be willing to speak with us about Jens, Elizabeth, and Jim Farmer. He responded by email. Hi, Courtney. Thank you for your courteous overture. These were people I knew only very slightly, and I have no memory of any event or conversation that would be of use in your project. That is all I have to say, or will have to say, on this subject. I wish you well in your endeavors, he wrote. With that flimsy evidence as Robin's only alleged link to the case, we didn't see any value in pursuing that lead any further. That left Jim Farmer, since Jens claims Elizabeth had been talking about him the night of the murders. Jim died in 2014, after working as a research analyst for Microsoft. Friends at UVA didn't recall a serious drug problem or know him as a drug dealer. But years later, an arrest for drug possession suggested lengthy issues with substance abuse. Chip Harding and Richard Hudson hoped to get some answers from Jim's parents, who are still living.
We found that at least in the summer months, they were living in Lynchburg in a retirement village, and we drove down and parked in the parking lot and made a phone call in. The judge answered the phone, very polite, and to our surprise, agreed to meet with us, and that his wife was at the book club, and we met him in the lobby and went up to his apartment and sat and talked.
Chip and Richard told Mr. Farmer they were hoping to find out Jim's blood type and asked him if he remembered. Mr. Farmer told them his son's blood type was A negative, which would exclude him as a source of any blood at the crime scene. When his wife got home, she confirmed that for Chip and Richard.
We felt pretty comfortable that they were telling us the truth. I mean, after all, he'd been a judge. His son was now deceased, and they both came up with the same blood type, and they seemed to do it, you know, in a casual, non-pre-planned manner. It still would be nice to either have some documentation.
We agreed. Documentation would be helpful, but DNA would be more conclusive. We were able to obtain a DNA sample from a close relative. Once again, we had Dr. McClintock do the comparison.
It looked like that profile didn't match the unidentified.
No, I mean, I was thinking before I even looked at it that, you know, there would be some ifs, you know, at certain sites, but there wasn't anything close on any of the sites.
Jim Farmer didn't bleed at the Haysom crime scene. These are the people that have been associated with this case as alternate suspects for decades. DNA testing has eliminated them, but that doesn't mean we've reached a dead end in our investigation. The DNA tested in 2009 was collected from cotton swabs used to collect blood from the crime scene. They had not been stored properly, but Chip says there are potentially 200 other pieces of evidence that have never been tested, including a large blood stain on a countertop that might contain a full DNA profile that could provide more answers if it was run through the state DNA databank. But Bedford has refused to conduct any additional tests. It's a source of frustration for Chip and other investigators who have reviewed the case.
you know, we can't do any more unless Bedford cooperated.
We reached out to Bedford Commonwealth's attorney, Wes Nance, early on in our investigation and found him accessible and transparent. When we called him again, he was happy to talk and answer any questions.
Hello, this is Wes.
We told him about our DNA comparisons, ruling out the drifters, and we asked why Bedford refuses to test crime scene evidence for DNA, since the only testing has come from those tiny swabs that were improperly stored. He said Bedford isn't stonewalling.
A Commonwealth attorney's position is obviously to do what is right and to do what is just. And we've certainly heard the calls for retesting, and we've tried to follow up with that with the lab. My understanding is there are going to be significant issues with whatever would be resent to the lab. First and foremost being that when items were introduced into evidence in the late 80s, the procedure was to allow public inspection of those items. Those items thus up until, well, I'm going to completely guesstimate 3 to 4 years ago, were finally sealed. But prior to that, they were open to a myriad of investigative reporters, defense experts, defense team members. And in fact, there's multiple photos of individuals touching these items without gloves on. That would leave touch DNA. And so if you were to send that stuff off to a lab, you wouldn't necessarily only be getting results from the night of the murders. You would get results for any person who has had contact with that from the time it was collected until the time it was retested in 2020 or whenever you did that.
Wes was not the Commonwealth's attorney at the time the crimes occurred and rejects the suggestion that he do anything to prevent the truth from being known.
I had nothing to do with the prosecution of Haysom. I have nothing to gain or to lose with either the proving of his guilt or the disproving of his guilt. So both myself and my predecessor, Mr. Krantz, now Judge Krantz, we called the lab multiple times about these same issues, but it's not black and white. There are multiple shades of gray.
One of those shades of gray, Wes says there's another plausible explanation for the unidentified DNA, one that doesn't leave two unidentified killers on the loose.
The defense theories that have pointed allegedly to Soaring's innocence was the idea that his DNA did not match the profiles retrieved from the crime scene. The problem with that is the profiles from the crime scene are so partial that it's very difficult to make any strong comparison. And it is just as likely that the profiles that are supposedly being labeled as coming from the quote-unquote real killer are actually the victim's blood himself.
But how could the DNA from O blood belong to Derek Haysom? He had A blood. And the AB blood found couldn't belong to Nancy Haysom, even though that is her blood type. The DNA from that blood had a Y chromosome, which means it had to be from a man. It turns out there's one possible explanation that would turn everything we thought we knew upside down. We reached out to Dr. Dan Crane, a DNA expert from Wright State University in Ohio. He had consulted with the ABC News Magazine show 2020 back in 2018 about the Haysom murders and Soaring's claims. He says the problem with Yen's DNA defense is the assumption that the DNA came from the same person as the blood. The type O and type AB blood stains collected from the door and the kitchen counter could have contained DNA from another person, and that could be what was picked up by the DNA test in 2009. He cautions against using blood typing tests interchangeably with DNA tests. That's what Jens has done when he's explained it to us.
This whole argument is the O blood that was thought to have been Jens Soaring's doesn't match when they did the DNA testing, so it's not his O blood.
Right. I'll tell you, it's not a good idea to try to draw too strong a connection between serological test results, like the ones that give rise to the ABO blood typing system, and DNA test results. I think we need to keep in mind that they're actually looking at different things.
What Dr. Crane is saying is that in a messy crime scene created by a knife attack, you may have a pool of blood from one person and DNA from sweat, blood, or saliva from a second person mixed together.
The DNA testing may then be picking up on the saliva or the skin cell part of the sample, which could be present at a higher quantity or may be in a better state of preservation with the passage of time than the proteins that give rise to the serological test results. And so what you may be seeing is a DNA profile that comes from one kind of tissue or source of DNA and a blood type that comes from a different source of tissue, most likely blood.
We asked Dr. Crane what it means for Yen's case and his efforts to clear his name.
I do not see compelling evidence of a wrongful conviction.
Next, on Small Town, Big Crime, we go back to the beginning with a new eyewitness to the crime scene. What clues did we miss? And is this idea of someone else's DNA in a bloodstain legit?
Been 35 years. If I could print my memories, I could print you crime scene photography because it's that vivid. Blood has a smell and blood has a taste, and you had both. There was so much blood in that house that you could smell it and taste it.
And we find a group of people determined to prove Yen's guilt once and for all.
He's still proving that Yen's drove to Loose Chippings and murdered the Hasems by himself. I mean, well, the proof's right there in his report.
Hi, this is Courtney Stewart. If you're enjoying this podcast and appreciate our work, please consider supporting us on Patreon. This type of investigative journalism is labor-intensive and expensive. Rachel and I are working on a new case for season 2, and we can't do it without your help. Check out our Patreon page, Small Town, Big Crime.
Hi, this is Rachel Ryan. When Courtney and I first started our podcast, we found the perfect place to work and network, Common House in Charlottesville. Now people in cities across the country and even around the world can benefit from a Common House membership. With other locations in Richmond and Chattanooga, Tennessee, thousands of creative types, entrepreneurs, and other professionals like you are finding a social club that helps them make new connections, both personal and professional. Each location offers gorgeous, comfortable spaces for conversation, quiet spots for working, and tons of planned activities that spark conversation and networking. A Common House membership also comes with global benefits. You'll get access to dozens of clubs around the world, from San Francisco to London to Auckland to Singapore. Don't just take our word for it. Come check out Common House yourself. And if you spot us there, say hello.